Well, good morning again. Should probably turn that on. All right. When I said that I was going to preach on the shortest passage of Matthew that I was going to probably cover a few weeks ago, I lied. Today is going to be the shortest. Part of that was because it just got encapsulated so well, and part of that is knowing that I should not go very long today. There's less props. We're not going to do a lot of that. Some Generation Sundays, we make it very kid-friendly. Today will be a little bit more traditional, but hopefully with some understandability for all ages in the room. But it is Palm Sunday, too. And if you don't notice, we're not waving a bunch of palms around the room. But it is always our reminder. Easter's a week away. And today, it's a day that we celebrate Jesus riding into Jerusalem. If you've been following along with Matthew, we've been preaching through the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew, Mark, and Luke really have Jesus up in Galilee pretty much the whole story, other than the birth of Jesus. And now is sort of his arrival to Jerusalem. And we celebrate that on Palm Sunday. It's a unique day. But the day itself has so much tied into the actual text we're teaching on this week. And so it just became great. It became like the perfect setup heading into Easter. It's even our change of liturgical colors today to red, getting ready for the shift to white come Easter. And so there's a little bit of history lesson I need to cover today. I figured I'd get this out of the way before everybody's too bored to not pay attention anymore. But between the Old and the New Testament, there was a lot of history that happened. A lot of history that, depending on what kind of Bible you have, you may have in your Bible or you may not. As we leave the Old Testament, there's no Greeks, there's no Romans on the scene, and then as we pick up in the New Testament, suddenly there's Greeks and Romans all over the place. And the Greeks had come to Israel hundreds of years kind of before Jesus' time, along with Alexander the Great, and kind of taken over quite an empire throughout the area. And one of the people in charge, that was put in charge of the area that Israel was in, was Antiochus Epiphanes. Here's a picture of Antiochus Epiphanes holding a pig. There's a reason. There's a reason why this picture has him holding a pig. Antiochus Epiphanes really, really disliked the Jewish people. He tried to outlaw most practices. He tried to outlaw the Torah. He had it burned for various reasons. He tried to outlaw circumcision. All these things. And as the story would go, he eventually went into the temple area and sacrificed a pig, and became known as the abomination of desolation, this practice of what this man did, and desecrated the temple. So you would imagine the Jewish people were not so happy with Epiphanes. And so they responded as they would. He was the worst. And eventually a revolt would come along, that there would be sort of this family called the Maccabees, led by Judah Maccabee, and they revolted. And so here's another picture of Judah Maccabee and his ragtag collection of Jewish soldiers ready to go into this battle. And they won. They fought and they won. They gained the independence of Israel, at least for a short period of time, before the Romans show up to town. He was a war hero. He was the George Washington, in some ways, of the Israelites, fighting for the independence of his country against the outside groups. Books would be written, songs would be sung for the Maccabees on the day that Judas Maccabee rose up and drove out the foreign occupation. And as part of the rededication of the temple itself, there was a holiday in the fall called the Feast of Booths, and they hadn't celebrated it. And so they kind of celebrate it, but they do it in December a little bit. And there was some candles that wouldn't go out. And so now we have Hanukkah. It became sort of the birth of the Hanukkah holiday. And with that, it came palm branches too. Palm branches were normally associated with sort of fall festivals, but they used it as part of this, hey, we didn't do our fall festivals. We're doing them now. And they started waving palm branches as part of their celebration. And the palm branch started becoming this symbol of revolution and independence. It's like the bald eagle or the Gadsden flag, the sort of don't tread on me snake. It was like revolution, overthrow the government kind of understanding of things. So that was the symbol. And it would start showing up on coins. Eventually, hundreds of years later, the Romans would even outlaw the palm as a symbol because of the revolutionary nature to it. So fast forward, 200 years, from the Maccabees revolt to Jesus' time. In 100 years of Rome taking over, and that's where we find Jesus. He's the Messiah, he's the anointed one. Everyone expects him to be this king, the king that they've been waiting for. Surely the Messiah would set us free. He's finally here. That's what the prophets have been saying. This Messiah, this king to come in the line of David was finally going to come, finally going to give us independence. He's going to rule in Zion. Jerusalem will be restored. Rome will be kicked out. Everything will be set back. He's a mighty warrior in battle. The Messiah will win the day. That's what they were expecting. And on that Passover week, waiting for another deliverance, because once again, Passover had this sort of Independence Day kind of feel to it as well. It was the time when they were under Egypt, under oppression in Egypt, and God delivered them out from Egypt. It had such a big deal, they would break out their palm branches again as symbols of revolution. And on that day, Jesus would go riding into town. We have another picture with this beautiful symbol of the time, this revolution, this independence, and they're waving their palm branches. They're cheering for this Messiah that's coming to town. Hosanna, which means save us. And they start quoting Psalm 118, which is a psalm about military victory. This is fully what they expect Jesus to be doing. He is going to be the great warrior who wins the day. That's the greatness that they expected out of Jesus. And simultaneously, on that same day, likely, it's about a week before, another person would come riding into town on the other side of town from the west. It's a man named Pontius Pilate, a Roman governor in the area. So here would be a picture. He was coming to keep the peace for Rome. During this holiday, this Independence Day, this revolutionary day, Rome would necessarily need, or they would need to show up. And Pilate would show up on his war horse, flanked by hundreds of soldiers. With the decor and the regalia of Rome, it should almost remind us of how maybe Nazi symbolism worked. It was a sign of power and might, and don't stand against us. They wanted to make sure everyone knew who was really in charge in Jerusalem that week, and the greatness of Caesar himself. And so, we have these two images on Palm Sunday. One of a king riding a donkey, surrounded by mostly peasants, and one of a war horse and might and valor and soldiers and war and domination. And so, that's Palm Sunday. So let's date back, Matthew 18, and let's talk about what Jesus teaches here. So Matthew 18, verse 1, that's where we'll be. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." So remember, the expectation, and it seems like the disciples' full expectation up to this point in the gospel writing, is king and rule and victory and reign. So Jesus, who's going to be your vice president? Who else is great in this kingdom? And eventually, you'll see even a few of them be like, "So who gets to sit at your right hand? Like, who? What does it look like to rule with you? What does it look like to reign with you? Who's the greatest?" And this will be an ongoing conversation. Even one where one of their moms gets involved and is like, "Hey, I'm asking for my kids. Can they sit at your right hand?" And there's a different response depending on the situation, but let's look at what Jesus does here. Calling him a child and put him in the midst of them. "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." So this moment says, Jesus, who is the greatest? He grabs a child. He's like, "You want to talk about greatest? Let's talk about children." And the Greek actually implies like 6-year-olds or younger. This isn't like 12-year-olds or something. Like, it is definitely smaller children. And I've heard all sorts of teaching on this. I've probably taught all sorts of things on this. That children are innocent and have a childlike humility to them. And we just need to have that sort of attitude in us, a child's humility and character. But no offense to the children in this room, I don't know if humility is the best way to describe children. That's not been my experience. They seem quite confident in and of themselves. And so I'm not sure if that's really what Jesus might be after in this moment. Because there's two ways to really read this, right? The humility like the humility of a child, or the humility like the position or the lowliness of a child. And those are very different things. In social standing, they were, for most intents and purposes, on the lowest of the rungs. That there's not inherently, not an inherent humility that the child might possess. That's really not how the ancients even thought about children, but more about sort of the lowly status of a child. One commentator, Bruner, says, it is not so much the child's objective innocence and purity that's in view. It's the child's objective, it's the child's objective smallness and low status. The child, in the opinion of Jesus' culture, had to limit itself to listening and obeying. And although they would say they loved kids, in an agrarian or like a skilled labor society, children are largely functional, right? They are the ones who are going to be working the farm or to take over the business. As they get older, they become more valuable. But in a six-year-old or less stage, although they would love their children, there's no function yet. They're actually more time-consuming and take away from potential food and anything along those lines. Jesus, as if to say, you want to know what greatness is like? Let me get you the very opposite of how you would define greatness, put it here in the middle, and say, become like this. It's really what's happening. He completely flips the definition on its head. Bruner would go on and say, according to Jesus, it's not the significant one, the important one, the esteemed one, who in the world is considered great, but the little one, the unimpressive one, the one standing in the background in the shadow of the mighty ones, who is the person Jesus considers great. And the other gospel writers take the story. I mean, this is a repeated kind of moment, not just with the child, but with other characters as well. Like Mark. Mark constantly has his disciples not understand anything, right? And every other character understands what's happening. And there's a story like this in Mark's gospel where his disciples are like, hey, who's going to get to be the greatest? Jesus goes, what do you actually want? He's like, we just want to know who's going to be the greatest. And then he answers them about sort of servanthood and stuff like that. And then immediately after, there's this interaction with the blind man who asks the same question. Or Jesus goes, what do you want me to do for you? And he wants to be able to see. And so these disciples are asking about greatness, and it seems like they totally missed the point. And then Jesus asks the same question, and this man just goes, I just want to see. And Jesus brings him healing. That requesting for the power and position seemed to be sort of lost in the story. It's almost like adventures are missing the point. It has nothing to do with the bare request that God grants. It's as if to say that the simplicity of what this blind man, this outsider asks. So to answer the question of the greatest, Jesus could have easily, just as easily, grabbed someone who was experiencing a disability, a female slave in their time, someone whose society's eyes had completely dismissed. And Jesus brings him front and center. He says, here you go. Greatest. Do you want to know the greatest? I mean, we can look around the room. You want to know what the greatest in the kingdom looks like? It looks like Quinn. It looks like Kai Bowden. It looks like Malachi Turner. It looks like Hugh White. That's great. And it reminds me, back at Palm Sunday, you had this humble Jewish rabbi riding on a donkey, no weapons in hand, coming in from the east with his ragtag bunch of rejected disciples. Pilate riding on a stallion, Jesus on his donkey. Pilate with his soldiers, Jesus with his disciples. Pilate instilling fear, Jesus pronouncing favor. Pilate and his empire, and Jesus with his shalom, his peace. And here's the problem. We always say yes, humility, all those sort of things. But so many missed it then, and I would say so many of us still struggle with this now. Jesus was talking about humility upside down, and it sounds great, but they still missed it. And there's a weird irony to the story on this Palm Sunday. They're all waving their palms. They're so excited. So excited. Revolution. Jesus is here. The Messiah is here. It's going to be battle. This is going to be victory. And Jesus sees it all. And he weeps. And he says in Luke, "Would that you, even you, Jerusalem, had known on this day the thing that makes for peace." So I'm always like a little tense about whether or not we should wave a bunch of palm branches on a Sunday, because it's the thing that makes Jesus cry. So I always question it. But anyways, that's just my interpretation. But because the very prophecy that they start quoting Zechariah, it's really connected to this prophecy in Zechariah where the Messiah would ride the donkey into town. It's a big deal in Zechariah 9. And they're all shouting it. What they don't shout is the very next verse, which says, "I will cut off the chariot of Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he, the Messiah, shall speak peace to the nations. His rule shall be from sea to sea and from river to the ends of the earth." They want this great military leader in the Messiah. And Jesus says that the way of the world and the way of the Gentiles is about might and power and victory. And he looks at his disciples and says, "That shall not be so with you. Whoever wants to be great amongst you must be a servant. Whoever would be first amongst you must be slave to all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." It's so upside down of how we define great power. So what does it mean for us? What is great? What's a great church? What's a great leader? What's greatness in life? And this is open forum time. I know I skipped that on the front end this week, but here's where I want a little more interaction. Greatness according to the world. How would we answer that?
Money.
Money, yeah. Power, influence. What was that?
Status.
Status, yes, certain status. Those are all really good things, yeah. Yeah, I think there's probably a few categories. One's around achievement and success, so money, power, maybe conquering, maybe inventing something incredible or building something big. Sometimes the impact or contribution, maybe the number of followers and the influence, the width of an audience. Sometimes that's greatness in our world. Celebrity tends to be in that category. Sometimes it's charisma. I think we define greatness sometimes as some of the most charismatic people. They can articulate things well. They can be really persuasive and garner an audience because of it. But often these things require self-preservation, self-aggrandizement, upward mobility, utilizing power or privilege for self-promotion. And hear me, Christian leadership loves all these things too. You go to Christian leader websites and stuff like that, and they'll be like, read the best business books out there and do this kind of stuff. And it's a lot of this. Like there was one website I was at, and it talks about like the 8 keys to being a Christian leader. And the first 7 of them were things like charisma, have relationships, but they're essentially utilized for the purposes of the organization, all these sort of things that are super business-oriented. It's like be high in vision. And then they would quote Proverbs, which that proverb has nothing to do with business organizational vision. But they utilize it. And so you have all these things. And then out of the first 7, it's all business organization ones. And then number 8, tagged on the end, it's like, and be a servant. It's like, well, you wait until the 8th one for the one that's actually like Jesus. But greatness, according to Jesus, what does that look like? Some of the things we just covered, right? What does it look like? Humble.
Sacrifice.
What was that? Sure. Generous? Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, it's almost like power under. And there's ways to use. Jesus could use power over, even when he has the interaction with Pilate before he dies. He's like, I can call down 72,000 soldiers in this moment, or angels in this moment. People freak out when one angel shows up on the scene, let alone 72,000. And he has the power, but he utilizes it under to bring up sinners like you and me. Yeah. One way, this is kind of a longer definition, but I think it covers a lot. That greatness as a person is in a great cross-shaped kingdom, following a cross-shaped king. That by baptism, I would identify myself with the death of Jesus and take up a cross as a way of life, forsaking status-seeking, self-preservation, self-aggrandizement, and upward mobility, surrendering my power and privilege and right to comfort and safety, and embracing a self-giving love and self-expenditure instead of exploiting my rights and privileges for my own gain, so that I may imitate Christ by returning good for evil, blessing my enemy, praying for those who persecute me, refusing to retaliate, and promoting God's shalom, his peace, and flourishing for the sake of others. That, to me, is greatness. And I think that's how Jesus shows great throughout his whole life. What does it look like to be a great church then? At least according to world standards. If you're kind of more secular and you're looking on at the church, what does great churchness look like? Yeah, the ABCs, right? Attendance, buildings, and cash, right? It's the ABCs of what it looks like to be a healthy church. Attendance, buildings, cash. Yeah, maybe influence. How far reaching does a church's influence and power go? Yeah, kids programs, entertainment in some ways. What'd you say? Fog and lights. Fog and lights. Yeah. I don't want to go down that road because here's a little trick of what I want this experience to be. I don't want to start naming things and for us to think about that church over there, right? Like this should be an experiment to go to self look at who we are, what we do, and be critical of self. I'm always cautious to just throw stones and be like, at least we're not like that church with the fog and the lights and stuff like that. Which I understand we're not, and that's true, but as we process through greatness, I want to also critique where are we missing the mark and where we might define great in world standards and not New Testament standards. What else? Anything else? Yeah, being too heavily insider focused in terms of caring for ourselves, not caring for those in our neighborhoods. Yeah. We should love our neighbor as we love ourselves. Yeah, and I would once again have a definition to be cross-shaped communities that participate in God's renewing work in the world, offering hospitality and welcome to the outcast and marginalized, forsaking the dynamics of growth. The growth's not bad in and of itself. And growth for its own sake, success for its own sake, efficiency for its own sake, and instead embrace communal practices like lament and generosity and confession, table fellowship, justice, worship, faithfulness, for the sake of the world. That's what a healthy community should look like. That's what greatness should look like in the church. Not how well does this church meet my needs. Sometimes we define great churches that way. And I think Jesus completely flips it. How well do I get to pour out myself for others? That should be a measure of how good of a church is. More than are my immediate needs. Is the kids program really entertaining my kids? Is Chris charismatic enough on Sundays? Is the music engaging enough? Rather, can I be a part of this family where I can serve others and become more cross-shaped, actually be formed more into the image of Jesus day in and day out because of who I'm around, how they're shaping me, and become more humble and more lowly in the process. And I'm not sure the churches that sometimes we put 50 whatever churches in America right now are always focused on that. I'm not sure we're always focused on that. And I always want that check for us to examine. Do we define great church the way that Jesus does? Do we define great leadership the way that Jesus does? That we would have an unrelenting commitment to delivery of love and grace into the lives of others. Determination to live authentically and relate honestly. Unafraid to share weaknesses, inadequacies, and failures. If this isn't the place where we can't be like a child and go, I don't know, I've got these inadequacies, I failed here, and to bring those things into the light, I don't know where else we can go for those things. Power surrendering instead of power seeking. Focus on the flourishing of those under our care for us as leaders. Forsaking control and power. And that all of us would use any rights and privileges that we have for the sake of bringing up somebody else. And I think we all need to be dramatically reconfigured in how we think about greatness and allow God's words and God's spirit to actually shape us. Because I say I want Jesus' greatness. I want Jesus' kingdom, but I'm not sure if I'm really willing to pay the price. Like I say I love forgiveness, but far too many days I feel like I would be on that road on Palm Sunday, clutching my palm frond, shouting for revolution that comes by my understanding of power and might. And I think we need to ask some questions. Because I think sometimes our understanding of greatness still would make Jesus weep. Our thirst for power or influence or a particular kind of security would cause Jesus to lament over our cities and our churches. I think far too much of our culture has us looking for Pilate's entrance into Jerusalem instead of Jesus'. And perhaps this morning is an invitation from Jesus. Maybe as he looks over his shoulder, riding that donkey into town, asking, which kingdom do we really want? Do we want the revolution of the Messiah King that everyone thought? Do we want Rome with its might and power and ability to put the boot on the neck of anybody to keep them down? Or do we want the kingdom where the lowly child is a centerpiece of greatness? And I think that's where I leave us. And invite Sarah up for us to kind of sit in these things as well during this time to reflect, to pray, and then we'll continue to worship through song.